Blog Talk Radio. Everybody's got the fever. This is something we all know. Fever isn't such a new thing. Fever started long ago. Good evening and welcome to Lenny Godfrey Straight, No Chaser. Well, this evening I have a very special guest, someone I've known for a very long time but haven't seen for a long time. But before I get to my guest, I want to do a little housekeeping so that we can get that out of the way. The first thing that I want to do is to tell you all, those of you who are listening, but if you might later on want to call in and ask our guest a question, you should call 516-453-6063 and press 1. If you want to see this or hear this again, then you have the ability to do this after the broadcast is over at blogtalkradio.com/S as in Sam, F as in Fred, T as in Tom, H as in Harry, the number 2. And if both my guests and I have enough energy after all of this, we're going to do a little Zoom. It's called After Show Afterthoughts, and you'll be able to see that on Godly Entertainment and on Facebook. Or if you really are not a Facebook fan, then you can go to my website, www.lennygodfrey.com, contact me, and I'll send you all these things so you can get caught up. Now, enough of the housekeeping, and now to a bit of a breakaway, something that I don't do very often. I see that there's a question already, but let me start this first and then introduce my guest, and then we'll entertain you before we start. Here we go.
That 61 highway is the loneliest road that I know. Well, that 61 highway is the loneliest road that I know. She run from New York City, run right by my baby's door.
Well, I have to stop it right there, because if I don't stop it, I'll be playing it for the whole show. Welcome to my show, Lenny Godfrey Straight No Chaser, Mr. Guy Davis. How are you this evening?
Hey, Lenny, I'm doing fine. Oh, that sounded good on the radio.
We have to
and
do
you do
all.
Too.
Well, thank you. I am so happy that you are here with me tonight. I'm telling you, I'm just overflowing. What people don't know is that we knew each other when we were younger in college for a while, and I haven't seen you personally for all these years, and so that you said yes to my request to come on here, it just makes me feel so wonderful. Thank you, and welcome, welcome, welcome.
Well, darling, thank you for making me feel like family. I don't feel a bit less close to you than when I knew you. I know we have not laid eyes on each other in quite a while, but those times are precious to me. Education was back then, and it ain't stopped, you know.
I know it's the truth. You know, that's just one of the things. But wait a minute. I want There is someone who has a question very early on here that I think that they want to ask. So I'm going to bring them in and see how we can satisfy them. Hold on for a second, okay?
Okay, I'm right here.
Identify yourself and where you're from. Hello, welcome to Lenny Straight No Chaser.
Hello, this is Julius Hollingsworth, and I wanted to ask Guy, because I know he is he orchestrates music, he composes. When is he gonna create a blues opera, a blues folk opera? Looking forward to that. And Ms. Godfrey, I think Ms. Godfrey could direct it once you create it. So just looking forward to seeing or hearing it or sitting in a seat somewhere watching that.
Nobody has to identify. That was Julius Hollingsworth.
Yes, who went to school with all of us.
That's right, we were the triumvirate. Back at Hunter College.
Julius, I'm putting you on mute, Julius, because you're gonna start stuff up right now. I'm putting you right on mute. There's the famous Julius who's always trying to put us together on the stage some kind of way. At Julius Hollingsworth. Thank God for him. Well, that brings me though to talk to you about it. Now, the last we were together, you were doing things on the stage as an actor, all right? But talk to me about the Seeger. Is it John Seeger Camp, the camp that you used to go to?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Tell me about that. And that was before I knew you. You started when you were young going there, didn't you?
Yeah, I started at 8 years old. The camp was called Killooleet. I won't bother to spell it. John Seeger was the brother of Pete Seeger. Both have passed away now. But I was with the Seeger camp before I ever got to meet Pete Seeger, and Pete Seeger has figured in prominently in my life over many years as a mentor and a friend. John Seeger gave me so much of that flavor that I got to hear Pete Seeger's music before I ever saw or heard him. I mean, I heard songs like Kisses Sweeter Than Wine, for instance. Songs like Deportees, written by Woody Guthrie, that had to do with folks crossing into this country up from Mexico across the Rio Grande and getting returned. And there was an incident of an airplane full of immigrants that caught fire and dropped in California. I got to hear these songs that Pete sings and some that Pete doesn't sing since I was 8 years old, Lenny. And that was my first exposure to the five-string banjo. I fell in love with that instrument. I got to tell you now, see, 1960 was the year that I persuaded my father to get me a banjo. But you got to understand.
How did you persuade him? How did you persuade him? What did you say to your father?
I just said, Dad, I want a banjo. But understand that the world was a different place then than it is now. Back in 1960, that was only 6 years past Brown versus Board of Education. Where an integrated school was a constitutional right. It was established that a segregated school was anti-constitutional. Well, I'm sure my father would have loved to get me something beside a banjo, because the banjo was looked upon back toward slave times and minstrels and this and that and the other. But fortunately, my father did not saddle me with the stigma that the banjo is something a black man must not play. Let me play the banjo 1960 at a tender age, and it has served me over these many years.
Did you study or did you teach yourself?
I had some lessons, but a lot of it I taught myself. I think when I was 8, my mom had a fellow come in and give me lessons for a bunch of months. And so I learned the basic strums. And then when I went back to the camp, which I went to for like five consecutive summers, I would get more lessons. And then I put the banjo down for about 10 years and didn't pick it up again till I was 18. Then I put it down for about 10 more years. Then I was 20. And it kept going like that until one day, late in my 30s, it sort of caught on to me, and I haven't put it down since.
Oh.
I was studying that little kind of banjo, learning the strum that came out of Africa, out of West Africa.
Mm-hmm.
So, there's a lot of roots with that instrument, and I've been studying it.
Well, now, I've been trying to catch a lot of the interviews that you've done with other people and your passion for the blues. And in one particular interview we were talking a little bit ago, you talked about the men that worked on the railroad, and when they hit that nail down on the railroad, how you feel that that's a part of the blues for you. Do you remember talking a little bit about that on the many interviews that you do and how that affects you when you're singing? I want to hear something about that.
Oh, Lenny, Godfrey, let me tell you, darling. The work songs, the field hollers, that is what the blues was made up out of. If you think of the blues as starting around 1900 and maybe before, the earliest sounds of the blues didn't sound like when you listen to B.B. King and Howlin' Wolf and Buddy Guy. Those early strains sounded like Blind Lemon Jefferson and Lead Belly, so there was a lot of old country kind of style in it. But you could hear the beginnings, the earliest parts of the blues. Now, Lead Belly was a man who knew about hammer and spikes and about having to chop trees and being on a work gang, you know, sentenced to a prison or something like that. I became aware of work songs and crossing over with the blues even before I knew what it was. At that summer camp, they had a song called Long Gone by the man who had run off the chain gang. And
yes.
Now this song, it reflects the truth. Lead Belly literally, and I mean literally, sang his way out of prison twice. One was for the governor of Louisiana. The other was for the governor of Texas. Upon the end of both of their terms, Lead Belly had been doing time, serious time. Both of those governors left a paper on their desk saying Lead Belly could go free. And you just got to hear me do just like a little old piece of this thing here. Just a little. Let me just get you a little bit of this verb. Want to tell you the story about Riley Brown. He was a moonshine maker from outside town. Sheriff went to get him and he drawed his gun. That's when Riley began to run. He long gone. He long gone. Like a turkey through the cone. With his long clothes on. He's long gone. He's long gone. Had a special pair of shoes that he kept in a sack. Had a heel in the front and a heel in the back. Riley took off when he heard the hounds coming. Couldn't tell which way Riley was a-running. He long gone. He long gone. Like a turkey through the cone. With his long clothes on. He long gone. That's a little sample.
Oh,
just to let you know.
Oh, that's fabulous. That is that. Now,
baby,
all right.
Now,
how
I
long
took lyrics.
Now,
oh, there was one thing. I took lyrics from an actual work song that I heard recordings of.
Yes.
Long gone. Yeah, that,
yes.
That he's long gone. So I moved it around a bunch, but I started with a real work gang song. Just want to say that.
That's fabulous. Now, I that's one of the songs that I pulled up, Long Gone. I really was going to ask you about that, but now, you know, you've told me. But there's another thing that I want to ask you about. Before we get to the acting that gets you into the blues, let me ask you a couple of things about the blues. You talked about the difference between the king of the blues and the pope of the blues. Do you remember that? I think
yeah.
Muddy Waters was the pope And Harlan Wolf was the king.
Yes, Harlan Wolf was the king.
Yes. Now tell me what do you mean by that? Tell me what do you mean by that?
Okay, so this is all personal for me because people got their own ideas of who's in charge of the blues.
Mm-hmm.
Harlan Wolf had something straight up out the cotton patch. I don't know how to explain it, but he came into the cities. He eventually got up to Chicago where he could be heard, and he got electric instruments. But his voice was always from way back in the country, talking
mm-hmm.
about, I asked for water, she gave me gasoline. I mean, he had these old verses. And so he wasn't trying to be the king, but he was in the mm-hmm. depths of his soul. But now
mm-hmm.
Muddy Waters, I would watch him get on stage with a bunch of musicians. He'd like sway from side to side. You know how they do in like the Baptist Church choir, how they sway from side to side when they're
oh,
singing?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Muddy had
oh, yeah.
that sway, and the whole band would sway with him. But instead of the angelic voices, he would take that guitar and twang it just right, make the church sisters start sweating. I mean, Muddy Waters. You got to say, thing about a mannish boy, and somebody, he's the hoochie-coochie man. You just had to love them songs of testosterone filled. But there's something fascinating about watching him singing those songs. And I've seen him in front of the black bands that he gathered and known musicians that he worked with, like Buddy Guy and Willie Big Eyes Smith and James Cotton, people who I got to talk with and interact with. Muddy could also stand in front of that group they called The Band that used to play behind Bob Dylan.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody knew his stuff, and they played the Taj Mahal. They played the Jam Dookie out of it. I mean, they played Man Is Born and stuff like that. And it didn't matter what band Muddy was in front of. Somehow it just became an experience like being in church. You didn't want to hear anybody play it better or do great variations on it. I just wanted to hear the same thing. Just it would be a little more excellent each time I heard it. So
mm-hmm.
it's like the liturgy in the church, hearing Muddy Waters recite the blues. I mean, yeah, Muddy Waters, he was the Pope.
Yeah, Muddy Waters was the Pope, and Harlan Wolf was the king. Well, now, what I want to do, and this is my own personal bridging, is to bridge you from us sitting in Lloyd's class and working with Julius on plays to this. You come from the theater. You come and have done the theater. How do you feel about the theater and bridging it to the blues right now? How do you is there a connection? Do you become two different people when you do it? Where is it in your life now, talking about the theater? Talking about the theater for a second.
The theater, Lenny, stays with me. And always will. Yes, I came up in that. My parents, when my sisters and I were young, they would take us with them. So we got to see plays from in the audience. We got to see them from standing backstage, watching the actors do the entrances, the exits, the makeup, the excitement. We got to see musicals on stage or off stage. The blues, where I get to perform, to me, it's a lot like the theater. Because the theater exists to tell stories. Now in the theater, you can have like 15 people up on the stage acting out a tale, and they're all talking to each other. And first this happens, then that happens, and the last thing happens, and the boy drowned in the river, and the whole community come together by torchlight. Or a blues man can come out there, or a blues woman, and sing one song,
mm-hmm.
High Water Everywhere. And
mm-hmm.
he or she is telling a story. What's in common is the story. Now, but when the blues singer sings it or tells that tale, it's just enough words so that your mind can picture it sort of as it's happening. Muddy Waters had that gift. Howlin' Wolf had that gift that when he sang, you could get a picture of what's going on. Garrison Keillor, the great storyteller from radio,
yes, great storyteller.
Companion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Same gift, the
mm-hmm.
gift of using just enough words so that you could picture it. Not too many words, then it becomes technical. Not too few words, because your mind doesn't know where to go, where to land. But just the right amount of the right words. Now, theater and blues is interconnected to me because the stories will always be there. I got stories coming from back in my family that reflect the blues. Now, understand, I grew up a child of privilege, a child of wealth. I had parents who were willing to send me anywhere, everywhere I wanted to go, and I wound up doing what I wanted to do. But my dad's dad and my mom's dad, oh, my God, that was like this, the countryside of the blues and the city side of the blues, respectively. And I got stories. I got blues stories to tell.
I want to explore that a little bit more. Now, let's talk about your dad's dad a little bit, because I want to make sure that tell me what part of – was that the southern part of your family? Is that what it was?
Yes, it was the more directly southern part, even though my mom's family, if you go back another generation, it's right into the south and to North Carolina. But my dad's dad was definitely a southern man. First we know of him is from Georgia. That's where he met and married my grandmother. That's where my dad was born. He was the head man on a team of trackliners. And they would sing those work songs. They would, you know, hammer the spikes. They would line the track, beat anybody, get your fair brown back. I can dance to tell, I can do this. Okay. Well, my granddad was a big black man, used to carry a pistol. And one time, my grandmother ran up the railroad track where he and the men were working. She had just come from the house because the Ku Klux Klan had left a note in at the house. They hammered a spike, a stick into the yard. They split the top of it and wedged a letter, a note into the top of that stick. And that note had a pencil drawing of a pistol shooting a bullet through a heart and the heart dripping down blood on a coffin. And that was meant to say to my grandfather and mother to leave, to go or die. Now, my grandfather was out there with his men. My grandmother handed him the note, and she took the pistol out of her bosom when she carried up the railroad track, and he took it. And when they went back home that evening, all my grandfather's men with their rifles and pistols laid around in the yard that night waiting for the Klan to come, but they never came. So, yeah, I got stories. I got the blues. I got heartache and sorrow. I've got laughter. I've had it all up in here. Everything that makes good theater and makes good blues singing.
And that's just fascinating. I mean, you know, I'm always fascinated about our lineages where we, because we're old souls, a lot of us, and we're old souls because we hear stories. Now, you heard that story from your grandfather or from your father? Which one?
I heard it from my father. I didn't get the benefit of a lot of time with my grandfather, but I did get time with my grandmother. So my father and my grandmother filled me in on that more than anybody else. Also, one or two of my uncles told me some stories.
And do you have some of those lyrics in some of the things that you write, Guy? You know, and so now I'm getting, you know, to the artiste part of you. The things that you write, do they start out as poems? Do they start out as stories? How do your songs evolve? And there are a couple of them that I want to ask you about, of course, and, you know, well, Long Gone was one of them, but now that you've already sung it, it's just fabulous. But songs that you've written, how does that evolve, and what influence does theater or the arts have into it, or what influence does do the stories that you have influence? I mean, recall, like, the beginning of a song that you've written.
Okay. I wrote a song called Sugar Belly.
Mm-hmm.
And the song Sugar Belly is about a young, beautiful black girl just getting ready to become a woman who is murdered by a man. In the story that I've written, the song that I've written, her mother is a white woman with beautiful green eyes, and her dad is a black man. and they live on the white folks' land. You know, it's all on the white folks' land. And when the white man was off from his wife, that black wife sent for this black man to come in there to fix something other, and they wound up. She got pregnant, had to go away, have a child. She came home and said the baby had been born stillborn, but she left her daughter, this beautiful girl, at an orphanage for the colored. Anyway, a dozen years later, the orphanage burns down, and the young woman shows back up in town, and nobody will touch her. Nobody will look at her because she has green eyes, like her mother. She has green eyes, and nobody's saying nothing. Nobody's saying who she belongs to, but they can all see. And she goes to work in a brothel, and all these men show up at it. And there's one man who was a jealous lover, and he wants her so bad he strangles her to death. And in the song, I have Sugar Belly eventually getting on up to heaven. First, the devil claims her. But then angels come down to say, no, in death her curse is lifted, so you can't have her. So they bring her back on up to heaven. Lenny, this is just a song, but this came from a tale that is circulated in my family, because there was a woman who was murdered, and my family knew the man who killed her. That's my father, brothers, my grandmother, they knew this man. And my uncle was able to tell me the last words this woman ever spoke while she was alive. And I'm thinking, how could he know that? How could anybody know that unless they were, you know, there? And what happened was that woman said, I know why you brought me here, and the fella killed her. In real life, the fellow who killed her was not her lover, but it was a black man sent by a white man who wanted her. And the white man was one of the county fathers. Well, this man who did the killing, he drank himself to death, and he told on himself in the midst of his drunken rages. He told what he did. So that's how my uncle came to know those last words. This same man, and I'm going to leave it here, was sent around one time by the White County Fathers to kill my grandfather. And so he showed up, but my grandfather stood there. And when the man said what he had to say, my grandfather opened his jacket and showed this black man that pistol. And said he wasn't afraid of him. So that man never did kill my grandfather. Otherwise, you and I'd be having a pretty different interview right here.
So anyway,
So I'll just sum that up by saying I wrote a song called Sugar Belly. Now, Sugar Belly is not factual, but I wrote it because every time I heard that story about this woman who never was given a name in these stories or a face, they never said what she looked like, I just thought it was so unfair and so horrible for somebody's life to be taken like that. And
now, have you recorded this song, Guy?
Yes, I have recorded it. It won't be coming out in this next recording, but the entire CD will be called Sugar Belly. And if what Julius Hollingsworth wants is a blues opera, Sugar Belly would probably be the perfect title. I don't know that I'm setting it up to be an opera, but I imagine it could, because it's got lots of songs, arias, so to speak, blues aria.
Well, you know, I mean, you compose, and I would think, you know, a compilation of your works, but that's for another conversation for us to have. For me to encourage you to do something like that, because you do come from that background where the marriage of these two things would really be a wonderful, a different kind of concept that that would be presented in the arts, you know, because there is no blues.
Darling, I got to step on it right here and say it's not technically an opera, but I did write a one-person audio play. Audio play on the CD, but I do it on the stage. It's called The Adventures of Fishy Waters in Bed with the Blues. And I wrote this thing, 25, 26, 27 years ago, and only now have I become old enough to do it more convincingly than back then. And in this play, I get to sing songs and I get to tell stories. Those are my favorite things in the world to do. The Adventures of Fishy Waters in Bed with the Blues. And as a matter of fact, if folks get greedy and want to know about it, you can go to GuyDavis.com.
Good.
And they got a list of all my recordings. So it's listed as an audio play. But I have performed this play over in up in Canada, over in Australia, around in the States. I can't think of all the places I've done it, but I have done this play. And now I only do it, once in a while. But I've done it. I've had runs of this play. I did it at the Crossroads Theater over in New Brunswick. What was it, 10, 11 years ago? Yeah. Had one of its best runs. I've done it on the legendary Rhythm and Blues Cruise. Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. I've done this play.
That's
just that play. This ain't even Sugar Belly yet. I'm still writing Sugar Belly.
But you also have, I want to talk about some of the believe it or not, we only have about 20-something minutes left, so I have to get all this stuff in because I knew this was going to happen. I want to talk about some of the songs that you've written. You've written a song about Greenwood.
Yes,
I know you speak, yes. And I've directed a piece by Celeste Walker about Greenwood and American Dream Destroyed. Tell me how that came about for you. There are a couple of other songs that I want to talk to you about. Let me start with the one about Greenwood and the pictorial, the vision that you had in your mind when you were putting down the lyrics for it. Talk to me about that.
Okay, let me tell you about this. The fact of it being about Greenwood has only come about in the last 2.5 years or so. The song is called God's Gonna Make Things Over, and various lyrics have been ruminating in my mind for must be 12 years. That has been somewhere in me. God's gonna make things over one of these days. I went to Tulsa, Oklahoma. I went to the Greenwood Center. I saw their exhibit and the photographs of so many people who were alive during that terrible massacre. And I've seen documentaries about it. And I didn't get to meet any of the survivors, but I got to meet and see the progeny, the sons and daughters of people who survived it. And that night, after going to the Greenwood Cultural Center, I kind of rejiggered my song and had some verses about the Greenwood Massacre in it. And since that time, I rewrote it for all of it to reflect the Greenwood Massacre. Now, it doesn't reflect it verbatim, but it's just the main idea that the refrain of this song, the chorus goes, "It ain't right. It ain't right what the white folks did in Greenwood on that night." And it's not so much to make white people go on some terrible guilt trip as it is an appeal to everyone's humanity.
Exactly.
That's what it is.
Yes, that's the telling tale the story does do. It's not to make people feel guilty. It's just to appeal to the humanity. And yes, I understand what you're saying. Go ahead. Keep going.
Okay. So the fact of the oppression of black folks in Greenwood, the wiping out of what they call Black Wall Street, was one thing, white folks, that they also murdered a great number of Native Americans who lived in the area, during the Oklahoma oil boom, I guess, in the teens, maybe part of the 20s, they murdered the red people, stole their land. Lord, I mean, it was crazy. It was insane. But what was going on? So this piece, this song is included in this new CD coming up. And I guess now is the time, more than any other. Now's the time.
Well, Now, I've got a couple of songs that I want to ask you about. I wanted to ask you about The Chocolate Man. Where did that come for you? And was that included in a film, or am I just imagining that I've heard it before?
Not to my knowledge, it was not included in a film. However, my dear friend Eric Bibb, son of Leon Bibb, included it in one of his CDs, which goes to audiences, some of which I'm not aware of, and it's been played around the world. It is, oh Lord, how many? We're talking at least 10, maybe close to 15 years old. That song's been around. Mm-hmm. The Chocolate Man. When I started writing it, there's only one rule I follow, which is the same I did for Greenwood, for same basically everything I write. That is, never edit while you're writing. Because if you're too busy trying to shape it, you might miss the best line of all, the best nugget. It's better that you write out 50 pages of work and throw it all away just to get to that 51st page than it is to try to get the 51st page right away. So The Chocolate Man, I'll tell you, Lenny, they talk about double entendre in the blues. Well, I had single entendre, double, triple. I had stuff that nobody ever wants to hear, family to hear. But that's because it just had to. And then when I looked at all those words, I had to decide what I wanted it to say. And I wanted it to be just lightly naughty, a little fresh. But not, I mean, some of them verses were downright rude. You understand? The kind of verses that have somebody come after you with a stick and whoop you. But that was me. I edited after I wrote out. It must have been at least three times as long as it is right now.
Well, here's another.
That's
now, I love the Kokomo Kid. Now, that you know, that I do love it. It's such, tell me how old that song is. Kokomo Kid.
I started writing that back in 2014, mm-hmm. and it would have been finished in 2015 and recorded in 2015.
Mm-hmm.
It tells a story that is not factual on the dotted line,
mm-hmm.
yet it's not entirely fictional because, well, as we know.
Well, hold on, because I want to play a little bit of it.
Okay.
I'm going to play a little bit of it.
Okay.
And hear it. Hold on. Let's hear it.
Okay. Back when prohibition was the law of the land, politicians knew we didn't understand that drinking was the way that laws got made. They got laid and bribes were paid. When the white bootleggers got sent to jail, nobody couldn't come go their bail except for Kokomo. Kokomo Kid. I'm talking about Kokomo. Kokomo Kid. Now when liquor got cut down, the government almost shut down. They needed a bag man who looked like a rag man, who better than a black man to come serve the white man his hoochie-fied liquor a whole lot quicker than a white bootlegger could do. They call me Kokomo. Kokomo Kid. Call me Kokomo. Kokomo Kid.
Now I want them to buy it. I don't want to play the whole thing now. Now that's just absolutely brilliant. Tell me how all of those concepts came to you, Guy. Talk to me.
Dolly, I'm not exactly sure, but there's no image I ever see or words or songs I ever hear that is wasted on me. I know at some point in some documentary I saw back in either the late 1800s, early 1900s, some sort of a liquor bust. There was illegal hooch going on. And apparently in one still shot, there was a black man with a star on his chest. And he wasn't dressed in a proper uniform. He had what looked like he could have been, you know, maybe selling hooch on the streets. But he was an undercover cop. It was clear from the photo. And that made me think, oh, man, all of the mess and crime and stuff that people could commit by doing what they say, and like that spook who sat up by the door thing. You know, nobody notices. It's a black cat over here. He's minding his business, or he's sweeping the street or something like that. Meantime, he's listening in on secret conversations, and he knows where the bodies are buried, and he knows where the money's hidden. Well, Kokomo Kid for me became that character. Kokomo, that character is the man who delivers coal to the White House in Washington, D.C., and he has to dump it down in the cellar. And the way Kokomo Kid operated was, if there were people who wanted to get into the White House who couldn't be seen coming in through the door, they'd go down that coal chute and come up on the inside, and then they'd leave the same way. And that was my premise with Kokomo Kid, because you know where money is involved, hooch is involved, liquor's involved. Yeah, there may still be racism, but black, they gonna get black folks up in that doing whatever needs to be done.
I believe
and if
that,
they
that,
know all the white bootleggers, see, they're not going to suspect the black ones of being up that high. So
exactly.
That was my premise for Kokomo Kid.
All right, so now I'm going to ask you a question that I'm going to tell you when I heard this song, and I don't know if you talked about it or if it's in the song now, because I've been listening to too many songs, the term hobo, and you wrote a song to your mother, for your mother. I wish I hadn't stayed away so long. I cannot tell you that tears came down my eyes. Talk to me about that song.
Before I even talk about the song, let me tell you what hobo means, just straight out, even before the song.
Okay.
Back after the Civil War, when black folks found themselves free, quote unquote, to make a living, they might take to the road and put a hoe over their shoulders or a shovel or a pick or something and tie their worldly belongings to it. And they were called hoe boys. And those hoe boys would walk wherever they had to go or get rides on, you know, trains or a mule, a wagon. That's the original hobo meaning was hoe boys. Now, the song, I Wish I Hadn't Stayed Away So Long. Lenny, my mom died in 2014. She made it to 91 years, almost 92, just about 91 years.
Mm-hmm.
And 91. There were times I got phone calls saying that, you know, your mom, it looks like she's leaving. You better get here. And there were times I could not get home. It was more than once. But fortunately, those times, she did survive. But I recall how I felt when I couldn't get home, thinking I might miss my mother. Well, one day I got a call. I did get there. And my mother did die that day. She died, and fortunately, my sisters were there. Their children were there. Everybody was there but my son, who came a little bit later. And it's funny, I wasn't exactly in the room when she died, though. But the thing is, with my line of work, I consider myself a hobo. So I put that line in the song, "Bell rang on the midnight train." When the hobos, I can't even remember my own line.
That was the one I could not get to play because I'm glad I did, because I would be crying afterwards anyway. But
it was "Bell Rang on the Midnight Train Carrying the Hobos Home." And hobos are anybody who can't stay home to work. You got to go where the work is. That's why I call myself a hobo.
And
why many of us perform as a hobo.
And that, after hearing that song, that's when I decided that I was one for a long time, for a very long time. And because this business makes you one, you know, you go where the work is. You go where the work is.
Mm-hmm.
I have to tell you, we only have about 10 more minutes left. I want to talk to you about Cafe Lena. I want to talk about your teaching, as well as your composing. I know you're saying, Lenny, you're worrying me to death, but I want, you know, the arc of your artistry is just so wide, and I want people to know all of it, that it encompasses, and we're not even touching all of it tonight. But talk to me about Cafe Lena. Now, tell people about Cafe Lena.
Cafe Lena is a place up in Saratoga Springs, New York. It's a horse town, a racing town. There was a sort of a young beatnik style, early day rather than latter day hippie kind of lady who set up a cafe, and performers would come up there, like people in their early days, like Dave Van Ronk and Bob Dylan and Richie Havens would come up and sing in this place. Peter, Paul, and Mary, Pete Seeger. They would come and sing, and it's just a small little place. Sometimes I imagine that they just pass the hat to pay the performers. Sometimes they get a wage. And there was a place smack next door to it, run by a black woman. I can't, so-and-so's kitchen. I cannot remember this lady's name, but she specialized in greens and fried chicken and cornbread right next door to it. So there was sort of a tandem establishment. I played up there live over the years, and just this past year during COVID, they asked me, I was asked by Cafe Lena, A, to come up there and do a socially distanced show. There wasn't but about four of us there, people doing sound and lights and recording. And they broadcast it on Zoom, I think it was, either Zoom or Facebook or YouTube, something like that.
Yes.
But beyond that, I was asked to do some guitar lessons on through Cafe Lena. So I sat here in front of this computer, and I had people signed on to Zoom, and I showed them things you can do with your guitar and asked them each to just sort of play it back, and I would sort of critique it and give them a little hint how you could make it a little bit better. So it wasn't any great comprehensive long line of lessons. It was just for a couple of months. We once a week would meet, and I would just give guitar lessons.
Well, let me, when you brought up the pandemic, and last week I had one of my other wonderful friends and what she was talking about, what Melba Tolliver was talking about, was she had heard a song, a couple of blues songs that were written in 1919 and I think 1920s about the influenza epidemic, one by Essie Jenkins. I think it was called Influenza Blues. And one by Blind Willie Johnson. And he wrote something like that said, Jesus is coming soon, talking about, you know, the end of life. Have you thought about, or have you written anything about this pandemic that we have been experiencing now? Have you written anything down about that?
Yes, I have written some songs. Some I do once in a while. One title I recall is I've Got an Angel 6 Feet Away. About a man who's attracted to a woman, and but they all have to mask up and go out, and the closest he can get to her is 6 feet. And so that's one song. But I've also got another song about things that have happened during this time, not cause of the virus. I know some people whose mates have died, not necessarily, not because of the virus, but this makes it such an isolated time. And I wrote another song for that. I've written just various songs for various aspects that include this disease. I can't even think of all the stuff, but I'll tell you one thing. During this pandemic, I've had time to write so much that I'd have to look over lists for names of songs that I had written. Songs about missing people, about missing my woman, about funny things, songs that have nothing to do with it, songs about civil rights, songs about everything.
And so, can't can't we hear some of your work on Facebook? Tell me how you do that.
Thank you, darling. Thank you very much for reminding me. Every morning except Saturdays at 10 a.m. on my Kokomo Kid Facebook page, that's Kokomo Kid, K-I-D-D, two D's at the end of that kid, I do a show called Coffee with Kokomo. And it only lasts about a half an hour. And we just get on there and I play some songs. I have the same theme song so everybody knows when it's me because they hear it. And then we do sort of a little coffee salute. You bring whatever kind of coffee you get. And I'm just like looking at the screen like you're there. And we have a cafe. We call it Kokomo's Cafe. And there's a woman there with a rolling pin named Ida Murphy. And everybody minds her. They have good manners because she's there. And we sit. We have coffee. Everybody talks. And I can't really see folks. But, you know, we do the best we can during these pandemic times. And so I get to present, I do two songs, every one of those shows, sometimes the songs I wrote, sometimes songs by people like Lead Belly, like I did this morning. So you can get on Kokomo Kid Facebook page and look up Coffee with Kokomo. I got a coffee mug I'm selling, all sorts of fun things.
You see that? Oh, my goodness. I'm telling you, you're an entrepreneur. Also, so along with all of that, you still have done some theater, though. I mean, you talk to me about Finian's Rainbow. Talk to me about a little bit.
Finian's Rainbow. Oh God, what a delight! One of the people who used to go to that summer camp run by John Seeker, who probably left a year after I got there, went on to become the producer of this play. Finian's Rainbow, the revival of this play. Back in 1947, the original Finian's Rainbow was put on Broadway and was the first fully integrated cast of a musical.
Yeah.
It was revolutionary in that on the stage, a black blues man named Sonny Terry, Blind Sonny Terry, they call him, came on that stage and he played harmonica while this lovely young woman danced to what he was playing. And it was just lovely. It was exciting. There is no recording existing of exactly what he played on stage as to, you could hear it, but it was transcribed. It was written down note for note. And there was some legal reason that they could not get that on that on the record album back in 1947.
Mm-hmm.
But I heard it played on a piano, and recognizing the way Sonny Terry plays, I could sort of catch most of that melody. I was offered this job, Lenny. I didn't have to audition for it, and that shook me in such a good way. But I knew I had to be better than I was, so I went home every night, and I worked on it as close as I could. I still cannot play all the notes and stuff that that man can play, Sonny Terry, but I did the best I could to give people a good sense of it. So that if somebody came in 2009 or 2010 and heard me playing that, they would recognize some of what they had heard back in 1947. Because I got the part that Sonny had. And
it's
pivotal in my life.
I had the honor of working with Burton Lane, who was the composer for the music of Finian's Rainbow. And he would always have to do Necessity. And the association with such a wonderful human being and his desire to have that show done again, I was so happy to hear that it was done again. I was away when it was, but I was so happy to hear that there was a revival of it and that you were in it. Which is just absolutely fabulous. You know, I'm just so fascinated by the arc of your work. Now, I have to be a good host, and I have to say that we only have about 5 minutes left, so I'm going to go back. Now, if anyone has any questions, we should do it now because we're going to run out of time. I'm going to go back to Julius because he hasn't put his question mark out yet. So I'm going to see if he has anything else that he wants to ask us. All right, hold on. Julius, I'm bringing you on air. It's Lenny and Guy. Do you have any other questions for us?
Guy, how many instruments do you play?
You know, how many?
Let
me enumerate them first. Okay, I play a guitar, 6 and 12 string. I play diatonic harmonicas, that's 2. I play percussion, so that's 3. I play Australian didgeridoo, that's 4. I don't get called on much for that.
What is that? Stop right there. Wait a minute. Australian what? What is that now? Didgeridoo.
Yes, you sit right there. I'm actually pulling up a didgeridoo while I'm talking to you so you can get a sense of it. It is a long tube made out of a tree. In Australia, the termites eat the trees up. So I got this. You have to circular breathe to do this thing. You'll hear this a little bit. It is this long tube.
That's
that is an Australian didgeridoo, a Crocodile Dundee stuff. I got stories too long for this show to tell you about how I learned to play that. So there's that. So I guess that, Julius, I guess that makes 5 or 6 instruments. Also the 5 and 6 string banjos I play. Oh, a little bit of mandolin. I'm working on that.
What about
you
play piano too, right?
Oh, okay. I compose at it, but I have faked my way into shows on the piano. I have. Oh, my God. I went to Carl Clay's Theater out in Queens, Black Spectrum Theater, and one day the piano player apparently was sick. Actually, it was a drug overdose, ultimately. And I had been to their rehearsals, and I cannot play piano pianistically in a way that he did. But I knew enough of the piece where I could get the basic chords out and do enough so that it wouldn't get in the way of the music. So I actually sat in during her show. I could play a little piano. Okay, we'll say 8.
Well, Now I've got to stop you because we're down to the last bit, and I really want to finish out with you pick either The Loneliest Road I Know or Kokomo Kid. Which one? You pick, Guy.
Can you tell me why I'm picking? What happens?
I want to end the show with you, not me, with you.
Oh, okay, baby. Let's make it Kokomo Kid. Get rest of that Kokomo Kid happen.
All right. Well, we have 90 seconds left, and I'm going to end this with Kokomo Kid, and I'll see you all next week, everyone, Wednesday, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and we'll have Chet Wise with us then talking about the arts and politics. But here's Guy Davis in Kokomo Kid.
When prohibition was the law of the land, politicians knew we didn't understand that drinking was the way that laws got made. They got laid and bribes were paid. When the white bootleggers got sent to jail, nobody couldn't come go their bail except for Kokomo. Kokomo Kid. I'm talking about Kokomo. Kokomo Kid. Now when liquor got cut down, the government almost shut down. They needed a bag man who looked like a rag man, who better than a black man to come serve the white man his hoochie-fied liquor a whole lot quicker than a white bootlegger could do. They call me Kokomo. Kokomo Kid. Call me Kokomo. Kokomo Kid. Buckskin mama got her very own drama. Come down from the mountain with the money that she counting for the governor of used to stay down south on the bottom. When I got him, when I shot him in the foot, trying to keep his ass pin out his mouth. They call me Kokomo, Kokomo Kid.
All right, and there is the end of our episode, everyone. Thank you so much for tuning in. Lenny Godfrey,
love.
No Chaser. Thank you, guys.
Love you, Lenny.
Love you, guys.